by and with youth experiencing homelessness in Portland. The evening will also feature a Q&A with the filmmakers, and a Lifetime Achievement Award will be presented to Tia Plimpton to recognize her decades of work and mentorship with homeless youth. Again, that's Outside the Frame's film screening of Leaving Home on Monday, November 13th at 6 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Deborah Marshall, and Deborah is a psychiatric survivor and human rights activist.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show, Deborah. And so you've been really an important figure in the European human rights movement around psychiatry and working with psychiatric survivor issues since 2008, is that right?
Being part of the activist movement has been really important to me personally.
So I'd like to speak more about your work with human rights organizing internationally, but tell us about your own involvement with the psychiatric system. And your family has a history of being psychiatric patients in hospitals, is that right?
My family are survivors of the Holocaust in Europe who came to Australia. And psychiatry, I think, was the way that distress and crisis and all of these feelings that couldn't be spoken about in relation to the Holocaust and trauma were processed in Australia. So I think my grandfather and different people in my family ended up in the system, on the receiving end of the system, but they didn't necessarily speak about it. It was something that was taboo and shameful. And yeah, I don't think Australia is the most open society in talking about these things either.
So the difficulty in talking about and working through those traumatic experiences with the Holocaust, that may have played a role in people ending up in the psychiatric system instead.
I'm sure. I think the thing that characterized Australia in the 50s and 60s and maybe still today was this need to just, you know, kind of smile and not talk about anything. And I think that suppressing emotion and trauma and difficult things and the history, the cultural history of the family was really important in the short term to surviving and assimilating. People changed their names. They didn't speak languages that they'd grown up speaking. They stopped talking about people who died in awful ways. Often they didn't know what had happened to those people, so there was no way of even creating a story that could be shared in the family. There was just a lot of private grief and guilt. I think when people survive something very difficult, often it means that they had to do things that they didn't necessarily want to do, and so there's guilt that can come with that, even though the actions are often incredibly understandable in retrospect.
So your relatives ended up in psychiatric hospitals and locked up and with different diagnoses.
It wasn't talked about. I don't know exactly what happened in some cases. What I know is that there was a lot of distress and pain, and that people, when the distress became too great, when life became unbearable, people sought help. And the natural progression of help still today in Australia is to end up in psychiatry. If you can't cope, it's seen as an individual problem, and you end up in psychiatry with some kind of medication regime or electroshock in the case of some of us, and then you suffer the results of that in addition to the trauma that you brought there in the first place. So yeah. I witnessed a lot of her suffering from when I was small, and it was frightening because she wasn't very verbal, but she was very, very distressed and very frustrated. And there was a lot of anger in her, and which was terrifying to a small child. And she didn't want to live. And that desire to die was so what I lived with from when I was very small, trying to protect her from what she said she wanted to do, and trying in some cases physically to stop her from hurting herself. So that was very hard, but that we never had a conversation about it. I think all these things are forces just that gravitate around you. Maybe they come out in gestures or the way that people, you know, place objects down, or there's something that is non-verbal but is palpable.
How did this affect you as a kid growing up?
I was incredibly nervous. I am an incredibly nervous person, and I was I felt very responsible for what was going on, and I was told I was responsible as well in a lot of cases. And so it wasn't only me inferring this, it was said that I could perhaps be better behaved, or I could be more respectful, I could be more loving, and I became very, very focused on school and on being able to transcend my environment by doing well at school.
And did you start going through your own experiences of distress? I mean, it sounds like this was a great deal of pain and suffering for you.
Yeah, I was very, very nervous, as I say. And as I got older and pressure got greater on me, I would be fine. Sometimes I would be able to perform under pressure, and then other times I couldn't. I was someone who was like an infant just curled up on the floor and not able to, that's how I appeared, not able to move and not able to communicate. I had huge problems around language, and language and words had always been very, very important to me, like very visceral. When I hear words, I can hear their music and they balance in a way. And when I would become anxious, I would become very alienated from words. I couldn't meet deadlines for work at school, which cost me quite a lot.
Were you able to communicate about your distress with your family? I mean, what were they there for you at all and supporting you, or was it just also part of this general taboo of talking about things?
To some degree, my dad understood because he'd had similar problems and at a similar age. And my dad has quite a difficult trauma history that he doesn't really connect with, but he's came to Australia as a child and was living in hiding in Poland. He had a false identity from when he was very small to when he was about 4 years old. He was Jewish, and he had to pretend he was Catholic, which meant he had a different name. He had to recite Catholic prayers. He had to suppress knowledge he had because it was incriminating and dangerous, and it could lead to people being killed. And then he came to Australia and had to be himself again in another context, to transmute himself. And so he understood. He'd had trouble with exams, and he'd had trouble performing in the way that people expected him to perform.
And how did you first get involved with mental health treatments and psychiatric interventions?
I was taken to psychiatrists and psychologists very early on, probably from when I was, I guess, about 12 or 13. I'm not sure. A lot of that part of my life is it all kind of muddies together, but it got worse, and I saw different people, many different people, and there were some very alienating experiences. I hated talking, and sometimes they would have my parents or my there at the same time, which really meant I couldn't talk. And then as I got older and the distress got worse, people started saying that it wasn't enough to be in outpatient and I should go in. And it was originally sort of suggested it would be for a few days, but that turned into many months, and it didn't achieve anything. It was awful.
Was there ever any connection made between the experiences that you were going through and the trauma history of your family and what you were living with on a day-to-day basis, with your mother's being in so much crisis and distress ongoing, and her ongoing suicidal feelings and suicide attempts, and all the trauma that was being played out in your family?
in a very, very superficial way by some people, but not really, and in a way that vilified my mum and was just saying, they remember people said, psychiatrists said that their patients are divided into the mad and the bad and the sad. I remember that, and that I was sad, and you know, and so that was kind of an okay status, but my mother was bad. And I did feel angry at my mum, of course. I felt angry at my mum. And there were times when I really wished that she would just go away. But this kind of lack of understanding of anything, and everything was incredibly superficial. Sometimes there was awful groups, and it did nothing. It was just awful.
And so a lot of medications and group meetings and therapy, it sounds like, and this went on for months and months in the system?
Yeah, it was not working, and I was very, very, it broke me in a way. I felt more and more hopeless and more separated from any possibility of things ever getting better and ever going. I had to drop out of university and of ever going back to university. I couldn't see any path out, and then it was suggested that I should have electroshock, and so that's what happened. There were a lot of moments that I realized, where I realized that we weren't seen as humans, we weren't seen as people, we were seen as these awful threats. There were psych nurses who wouldn't walk in front of us, they always had to walk behind us because they were acting like we would attack them, and we were not even thinking about anything like that. I remember seeing people self-harming and then being treated like they were these awful nuisance. Attention seeking was a word that was used all the time, and didn't deserve to be sutured, didn't deserve to be cared for or comforted. And of course the other patients would end up being the ones who provided that care, had meaningful relationships in hospital with some people who are still in my life and some people who are not alive. And I think a turning point for me was when I made a suicide attempt, and I ended up being treated in a way that was horrible. I always think that after you've been strapped down, something changes. The next time you walk into a store or you do something normal, you're not the same person. You've someone who's been strapped down, you've been treated like an animal, and I think that a lot of things that happen when people make suicide attempts are punishment. They have no healing effect. There's no understanding for someone in that situation, which is the most natural situation to be in so much distress that you want to get out. You know, like that's a human response to pain, is to try to stop the pain. And it's nothing from another planet. It's completely something that most caring friends understand, and many people can relate to, even though it's not a conversation that's easy to have. But I think that treatment and the use of nasal tubes with charcoal and in a very, very, very nasty way were designed to teach you a lesson so you wouldn't do it again. And I think it is very hard to move on from that. And I don't think I ever really wanted to talk about it, or I did talk about it. I think I just wanted to get up the next day and walk down the street and pretend to be someone that had never happened to. And that was very much how I lived my life in relation to psychiatry, was just not to talk about these things and many things that were much worse that happened to people around me. I think that I was fairly lucky, maybe because I was socialized to be compliant. Like I was a very shy girl, and after I had electroshock, it changed my personality a little bit. I became very, very, very angry. Like some people who are older, who are losing their memories, become very, very frustrated and angry. And I can remember how terrifying it was not to be able to, you know very basic words in the English language. Like potato, I think, was a word that I struggled with. And for me, that was terrifying because I never felt like I was anything more than my mind. And here was my mind just being dissembled, it seemed, and a very strange consciousness, because you are aware that this is happening to your mind. So it's you, but you're also losing yourself at that moment. And I think I was very lucky with electroshock in a way, because I think it's got much worse. I think now they apply it to both sides of people's head, and people have longer treatments, and it's the impact on memory is even worse. What I did go through traumatized me for sure. I just didn't talk about it.
How did you survive this? How did you make it out of that system to where you are today?
I was fortunate because I was able to stay at university. I had to drop out many times, but eventually I found a place for myself in the Russian department. It was like this very peripheral department in the university that no one really invested in, because Russian wasn't seen as some economically useful subject. And so I was able to get some money to get away from Australia, which was what I felt I needed to do. I didn't remember a lot of what had happened around ECT. I also knew that I continued to be a very distressed person, and I couldn't see how someone like me, who was sometimes okay, sometimes not okay, would ever be able to be financially independent, would ever be able to have a life independent of psychiatry. And I wanted to start again. I think that's what I felt I needed to escape. It was like almost another kind of suicide attempt. I wanted to end my life in Australia and start again where no one knew me. And I had so much shame about what had happened to me.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Deborah Marshall. And Deborah, let's talk about how you're living today, because some of the things, the traumas that you experience, I know that you're carrying with you, and also just the ways in which you're just different, the way that you learned as a child to just be different in the world. And I know that some of that was diagnosed, and they talk about thought disorder or personality disorder or different psychiatric labels for that.
There was a break in my biography, I guess, where I was not thinking about myself in terms of psychiatry at all. I moved to the Czech Republic and I found a job, not a very good job, but I found a job, and I was able to do things I never had, psychiatry had told me I wouldn't be able to do, like make enough money to buy stuff for myself and pay rent but I was still struggling a lot, and I was trying to figure out what had happened in Australia and to find a way to not be so distressed as I was all the time. Every time things would get overwhelming for me with deadlines or social pressures or anything, I would really, really struggle. I would suffer a lot. And I was very conscious about never appearing suicidal to other people, because I'd grown up knowing how awful it is to carry around fear that someone might hurt themselves. Like I was so conscious of that. And I always spoke about my effect in the world. That was like something psychiatry taught me. And then this got very exacerbated, and it led to a crisis, because I found out from a psychiatrist, a woman psychiatrist, who had seen me in Australia, that my diagnosis, which I hadn't ever known, was borderline personality disorder. And I remember when I read this, it was in an email the first time, and it was like something dropped through me. It was like myself shattered into 1,000 pieces. I can't really put into words how much this hurt me, and how alone and how ashamed I felt. And it was devastating. I wasn't able to function after that happened at all. My life stopped. And it was more than ECT, more than anything, that was the thing that made my life unlivable. Mm. I went looking for answers. I connected with a UK activist called Claire Shaw, who's done a lot of critical work about the diagnosis and the use of the diagnosis, especially against women. and the impact of the diagnosis, and does a lot of work on alternatives to support people in crisis, and is just she's a poet as well, someone who was very important to me. It was important to find that my experience that I was so ashamed of wasn't unique. I'd never actually met psychiatric survivors, people who were politically organizing, and I suppose I didn't even know I was looking for them. And then Claire had received another letter and a few other letters from people in a similar situation to me, people who had been so injured by this insult that their lives had stopped, and she put me in touch with them, and then we started to be a very small collective of women activists who were campaigning for the abolition of all psychiatric diagnoses, but especially of the personality disorders, which are their death sentence. You feel subhuman. You don't feel like a person who warrants care. And I stopped being able to socialize. I felt like if I was distressed, I shouldn't call my friends because that would be attention seeking. I couldn't seek care. I couldn't seek support.
Judith Herman, who's the author of the book, Trauma and Recovery, described the borderline personality disorder as essentially a sophisticated insult. It's the most dehumanizing of things you can say. And all the research connects trauma histories. So there's a very clear political aspect to this where people who really should be encouraged and supported to look at their histories and the social context of their experience and the way in which trauma has played itself out in their lives instead are pushed to seeing themselves as defective and seeing a problem inside of them, inside of their own selves, inside of their own personalities. And this question of personality disorder is very closely tied to the whole question of, well, how do you live differently in the world? Because you are somebody who has difficulty communicating. I'm someone who has difficulty communicating. And so it may be that there are times when I withdraw or I disengage and I'm not able to communicate or not able to speak. And it's not a symptom of my schizophrenia that I'm staying in my room and not talking to you about my feelings. That's a way of me going through my experience that's maybe different than other people, but it doesn't show that I'm defective or somehow genetically abnormal or there's somehow something wrong with me on my person level. It's just a way that I'm working through my experience that's different than other people.
I actually think that inviting someone, even someone who's struggling to communicate, which is often me, into a conversation and respecting their rhythm, respecting the speed and the time and whatever they need to feel safe, and letting it be in their own words, like the theorist Arthur Frank, who talks about letting people's stories breathe. And I think there is something in this aspiration, like in the, like literally being able to be safe, start to find words that make sense to you, that connect with you, that make you feel more part of the human language. And I think it's, we find our own ways and systems, and no one else has the right to tell you who you are or to explain your story to you, even if they think that they're doing you this giant favor by giving you a label.
I think you point to something really important. It's really about the power relations. Is it an empowering experience? Does it make someone feel more themselves, or does it put them in a position of dependency and control and something from the outside defining you from words that aren't yours, that don't really reflect your experience, but they're really more the clinical gaze of the clinician or the DSM or the doctor that is deciding for you what your experience is?
I agree with that. And I think that what is difficult for some activists, for me it's been difficult, is that there are people in the psychiatric patients who do connect with the clinical framework, respecting everyone's right to decide on how helpful psychiatry and its frameworks are is another part of it, which is some activism, I think, can err on the side of almost assuming that these people haven't reached consciousness yet. It's quite patronizing itself in the activist movement.
And that, I think, is in some ways plays out the shadow of psychiatry. And I think it comes from intense feelings of revenge and trauma and being hurt. But we have to be very careful about just not flipping the roles and doing the thing to the other side that we're so upset that they've been doing to us. Deborah, you've done a lot of work with international activists, people from all over the world who are working to change psychiatry. You've met a lot of different people from different countries and done a lot of traveling. What are some things that you've learned from the international scene, different cultures and different nations, that is inspiring to you?
Recently, I've been more involved with the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, which has been a really, really wonderful experience, especially to connect with people who are doing advocacy in Africa, in India, in parts of the world where there may be less psychiatry. There often is less psychiatry, or there's psychiatry in different forms, but mad people and distressed people are oppressed in the community at the same time. Connecting with people in Eastern Europe where there's no social welfare and there's no very, very few community services, and people have very, very distinct battles to even become economically separate from their family. So it could be a choice between a life in an institution or a life with a very, very oppressive family who's also violent towards you and controls everything you do. So I think that the loss of autonomy that we have as mad people and distressed people, that our right to decide on the really basic things in our lives and very crucial things, like whether to be part of psychiatry or part of any treatment that someone else proposes, taken away from us, is something that connects. I think that's been very helpful to see connections, but also to see asymmetries. I think that advocacy from the global north has been very, very powerful, and it's done some incredible things. It's achieved an enormous amount in international law, in all sorts of ways. But I think it's important not to impose that language or that way of working, you know, globally. I think I think it's important not to cherry pick human rights abusers, not to say, oh, well, this thing in Africa is, you know, it fits into our ideas about psychiatry. And certainly psychiatry is very, very frightening. The way psychiatry is spreading, the way it's being advocated by the World Health Organization and by many prominent academics and institutions in the West, in the Global South, is terrifying. But I think it's all about dialogue. And that's what's inspiring, to listen to people's own take on what's happening and what would actually help, you know, in locally, and then to ask what can we do together, what can we do to help each other.
Deborah, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Deborah Marshall. Deborah is a psychiatric survivor and human rights activist who grew up in Australia and today works as an editor in Prague, Czech Republic. And if you'd like to contact Deborah, you can send an email to the Madness Radio email address, which is info@madnessradio.net. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. After the Smoke Clears is the first in a series of educational public forums on the Eagle Creek Fire, and learn how our community can support the recovery of the Columbia River Gorge. The series will feature a combination of multimedia presentations on what happened in the fire and examinations of key challenges moving forward, featuring insights from a collection of noted fire ecologists, forestry researchers, and leaders from local businesses, conservation, and recreation organizations. Again, that's After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, November 6th, 2017. In local news, the City of Portland's Water Bureau has released their latest results for the testing of lead in the city's drinking water. 13.5% of the homes tested were found to have lead levels above the federal legal limit of 15 parts per billion. Last year, the rate was 12.5% above the legal limit. Federal law requires water districts to release the testing results to the public if the rate is above 10%. The city tested 134 homes they deemed to be at the highest risk of having elevated lead levels in the drinking water, and 18 were found to have higher than legally allowed levels of lead. Water Bureau officials believe that homes built or substantially remodeled between 1970 and 1985 are the most likely to have high levels of lead. During those years, the common solder used in plumbing contained lead. It is estimated there are up to 15,000 homes in Portland with high levels of lead in the drinking water. It is recommended that people run the water for 2 minutes before drinking or cooking with it